Going to start a new series this week, which I've entitled Valued by Jesus, about some people who, during Jesus' ministry, just really discovered that, quite like the story we've just heard from Marie in that video clip, they didn't feel valued by other people, but they found they were ultimately valued by Jesus. And this morning we're going to be looking at this story of a distraught father. So let's look at the scripture together that we are looking at this morning. It's from Mark. In fact, this series is all taken from Mark. It's some of those, with Mark you get quite small snippets of stories. Particularly in John's Gospel, of course, you'll have whole chapters where Jesus and is talking with someone else. But particularly in Mark's Gospel and the other, what we call synoptic Gospels, the Gospels that see things from a similar perspective, you often get these short stories, a few verses, but there's lots of depth there when you start to unpack what the verses are about. So I'm going to read this story from Mark chapter 5, and then we'll look at the words, look at the story together. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. Now there is a bit of story that goes in there. It is the story of the woman who had had the issue of blood for, I think it was 12 years. So but we're missing that out intentionally, and we're going to go on to verse 35. So while Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples all with him, and they went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kaum," which means in Aramaic, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. There we go. So there's a question that I'd like us to think about as we are looking at this passage about this incident where this distraught father meets Jesus and makes his request. And the question is, how does Jesus reassure us in times of sorrow and in times of crisis, times when we don't know where to turn, what to do? How does Jesus reassure us and come and meet our needs? And we have a number of words that Jesus says, or a number of ways in which Jesus responds. And in verse 36, we have this word from Jesus. Don't, or these words, this phrase from Jesus. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. I think it's one of the key things within human experience, how we carry our fears. I think we all have them. There's no point in pretending, oh, I don't have any of those. I that's not the way I am. I don't believe it's true. I don't care who you are, whether you are the president of the most powerful nation in the world, or whether you are somebody sat in this congregation, or whoever you are. I think we all have fears. We all have things that, I don't know about you, I'm struggling to sleep sometimes if I have to make a visit to the bathroom in the night. And then sometimes I'll lie back down again, I can't get back off to sleep. And I find that's the time when my fears, I'll start to mull things over in my head. And I sometimes just have to say to the Lord, Lord, give me the peace I need to go back to sleep. Doesn't always work, but I do ask. You know, we all carry our fears. You see, the interesting thing when I look at this passage is Jesus sees no distinction between the powerful and the powerless. He sees no distinction between those who have a lot of power within their own community and those who perhaps have none. So we have here in this story Jairus. Now actually he was a man of status who put his position at risk. He was one of the Jewish leaders in the area west of Lake Galilee. So Jesus had just been on the east side of Galilee, and we hear in these first couple of verses of this reading, Jesus went back over to the other side, and as he got to the other side, the west side of Lake Galilee, he was stopped by this religious leader. Now, of course, religious leaders in Jewish culture at that time were immensely powerful within the community. They very much decided who was righteous, who was acceptable, who was living a good life, and who was living a bad life, who was sinful, who was outside the religious community, who was accepted and who wasn't. It's interesting that the Jewish leaders were already turning against Jesus, even though actually this passage in Mark chapter 5 is quite early on in the story of Jesus' earthly ministry. Already in Mark chapter 3 verse 22, some teachers of the law have accused Jesus of being demonically possessed. They say you're possessed by Beelzebub, which was one of the names that they had for Satan. So they were turning against Jesus already. But for some reason, Jairus saw something in Jesus' ministry which caused him to risk his reputation. With all of his other religious male leaders, he was prepared to put that on all at risk, perhaps because of his desperation of his situation. He risked his reputation and his status. And he did all of that because of his terminally ill daughter, for whom there seems to be no hope. It's interesting, isn't it? We don't even know her name. This young girl, this 12-year-old girl. But as both a child and a female child, she was right at the bottom of the social hierarchy. Children were very much not regarded as having any work. You lost so many children, I think, back in those days, that to be honest, you didn't want to invest too much in them until they grew older, because they might not live till adulthood. But also as a woman, or as a girl who would grow into a woman, she was regarded as second class and very much would be restricted to family life, the home, rather than having any public role in society. But the lovely thing is, she was loved by her dad. And he obviously was so distraught by this, the fact that she was dying. And so he came and made this request. See, Jesus chooses to respond to the needs of both of these people. Jairus, his powerful position within the local community, and this terminally ill little girl who was on the point of dying. Jesus immediately responded to this need that was presented to him. Some of you know one of my favorite passages in the Old Testament is Isaiah chapter 43. And some of you will know I treated myself for my 60th birthday to a tattoo that I have here. I'm not going to bother showing it to you now. You can ask later. I might be prepared to show it to you. Isaiah chapter 43, these wonderful words. When you are in the fire, when you are in the flood, there are these two promises in verses 1 and 2 of Isaiah 43. Firstly, you are mine. You belong to me. It's about identity. And then secondly, I am with you. Because you are mine, there is no place you can go, there is no circumstances you can find yourself in which I am not with you. However difficult those circumstances are, I will always be with you. The Lord doesn't promise comfort or a trouble-free life. He promises those two things, identity and presence. And I'm reminded, of course, in this story, as with every story that we have of Jesus' healing ministry, that the healing that Jesus brought, if I say it was temporary, what I mean by that is Jairus' daughter one day did pass away. I hope she lived to a ripe age and lived a full and happy life. But she did pass away sometime else, much later in her life. We have this sense that the healing that Jesus brings in his earthly ministry is something that restores human life, but actually all of us one day will go to be with the Lord, we hope and pray and believe. But of course, the full healing that Jesus was bringing would be a restoration beyond this life of knowing who we are, knowing that we belong to the Lord, you are mine, knowing that we are with him, he is with us throughout eternity. We also have this statement. So we've had the phrase, don't be afraid. Straight afterwards, Jesus says to Jairus, just believe. Just believe. And this is one of these phrases that sometimes we really struggle with. Am I trying to force a sense of belief? And that if I believe it enough and sort of, then it'll be true. I don't think that's what it is. It's about knowing who it is that loves us and that we love and trusting their character, whatever is going to happen. Trusting, knowing that the person who we love, who has saved and redeemed us, is trustworthy and will be with us because we know who we are. So just believe. Despite the prejudices amongst his colleagues, Jairus had faith in Jesus. He says in verse 23, please come and put your hands on my daughter so that she will be healed and live. Please come and do that. Interestingly, Jairus' daughter was in no condition to have faith herself. She was so ill that she was on the point of death. Yet she was restored. We can bring anyone, even those who have no faith, before God in prayer. Even if they scorn the prayer that we are offering. We read in verse 40 of the reading there that when Jesus came and said, what's all this commotion and wailing outside the house of Jairus? He said, this child is not dead, but asleep. They laughed at him. What an idiot. He doesn't realize she's dead. Even those who scorn the prayers that we may offer, God doesn't heal on the basis of whether the person has enough faith. God's love is for all people. Whether they choose to worship him and love him or not, God loves us. He never stops loving us. He loved us before we ever chose, whilst we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He didn't wait until we were good enough. He loved us before we ever chose to love and serve him. We don't know in this story, these people who were wailing and making all this commotion, we don't know whether they were family members or friends, or whether they were the professional mourners. At the time, you would hire professional mourners to actually make a public display of a family's grief within their community. Now, we find that a bit weird, but their culture was a one in which the family showed the degree of their love for the person who had passed away by the outward showing of grief. Now, it's a different culture to us. We, you know, particularly those of us who are English and British, stiff upper lip, don't show any sort of, you know, keep it all very much to ourselves. That's not the culture that is being expressed here in this Middle Eastern context. But either way, whether they were family and friends or whether they were professional mourners, these people wailing and making this commotion, they had no faith or no sense that Jesus' intervention in this situation could make any difference. After all, the girl had died at this point. She wasn't just very, very ill. She had passed away. And I did think to myself as I was preparing this, how would I have been if I'd have been stood outside Jairus' house? Would I have had faith to believe that this preacher and healer who was coming here, who had taken his time about getting here because of a delay that we're going to look at in a moment, but could he make any difference? I don't know what the answer to that would have been. Would I have believed or would I have laughed? A question perhaps for all of us. I do just want to say that there is no formula for God's healing. We've had some wonderful, lovely Christian people in this church. That's not to say that you aren't all as well. But we have had some lovely Christian people in this church over the last 6 years. I'm 6 years here this month as the pastor. But we have had some lovely Christian people in this fellowship who have passed away. I'm not going to name any because there have been quite a few. It isn't a sign of the lack of God's love that they have gone to be with him. I do believe that the ultimate healing is when each one of us one day will be fully restored to the way that God created us and wanted us to be. And that is the ultimate healing, I believe. There is no formula. We are called to pray for those who are sick. There's that lovely verse in James chapter 5, verse 14. Is anyone sick? They should call the elders of the church together and pray for him or her. Now it says, and the sick person will be well. My experience has not been that. Sometimes we have prayed. Sometimes the medical interventions that have been used have brought that person back to health. There have been one or two occasions when particularly I have become aware of somebody with a particular condition, and it seems as though the medical staff didn't know what to do, and yet they were restored. But for others, that hasn't been the case. And I think all that we are called to pray. We are called to ask God to intervene in however he, in his wisdom, chooses to intervene. How the Lord chooses to respond to our prayers is his prerogative, not ours. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't pray. But we're praying from the context of that relationship that we have with God, that we know he loves us and wants the very best for us and understands perhaps the best for us even better than we know it ourselves. How God chooses to respond is his prerogative, not ours. So, we've had, don't be afraid, just believe. Now, Jesus doesn't actually say these words, but I think they're hinted at in these verses, verses 25 to 41. And there are three ways in which I think we can say that Jesus sees things differently to the other people in this encounter that he has in these verses. Firstly, Jesus found time for a distraction, which must have stressed out Jairus, you know? Now, this wasn't just any distraction. This was a spiritually significant distraction which Jesus discerned he had to respond to. Now, we didn't read the passage intentionally, but the passage, of course, is this woman who had had this issue of blood, which would have made her anemic. It would have really drained her strength and her endurance, and it must have been a dreadful thing to live with. And of course, she was the one who, as the crowd pressed around Jesus, she just grabbed the end of his coat, his cloak. And we're told that Jesus sensed the power go from him. He sensed there was somebody reaching her out who not only was desperate, but also had faith to believe that even touching Jesus' garment would bring the healing that she needed in her life. And so we have this amazing story, and Jesus stops and says, "Someone's touched me." And of course the disciples say, "Yeah, well, probably quite a few people because they're all squashed up against you." But Jesus knows, no, there's a difference. There's a difference between all these people who are jockeying and pushing to be as close as they can to me and somebody who is touching me for a particular reason that is so different to everyone else pressing around me. He knows the difference. And he stops and looks around. Who is it that touched me? And this woman, part of the issue, of course, was that in the Jewish faith, blood was seen as an unclean thing. So if a woman was on her period, she wouldn't be allowed to go to the synagogue. The Jewish people would always drain the blood out of any animals so that Jewish people would never ingest blood in a meal. Blood was seen as an unclean thing. So the fact that this woman had been suffering for 12 years would have meant that she was an outcast within her society. She would have been regarded as just unclean. And it would have been seen as a curse from God that she had to live in this way. So this is the distraction that Jesus responded to. Not just any distraction, but a particular situation that Jesus knew he had to respond to. And I think this is one of the key things in this passage, because I don't know about you, but in times of pressure and crisis, I find it difficult sometimes to prioritize, right? What's the next thing I need to do? And I sort of take this scattergun approach. Well, if I try to do a bit of that and a bit of that and a bit of that, then perhaps everybody will be happy. And it's very, very rarely the case. Actually, so often it's better. What is the thing that right now I need to do? And in this situation, Jesus knew that the priority wasn't to continue on with Jairus traveling to his home to see and minister to Jairus' daughter. Jesus knew, no, this is what I need to deal with right now. Everybody's pressing around me. Everybody has expectations of me, but I know what it is I need to do. I think that's one of the key things for us. How in times of crisis and trouble, how do we get that sense of what is it you want me to do right now, Lord? Is it to stop? Is it to pray? Is it to give somebody a telephone call? Is it to stop whatever I'm doing now and go and respond to such and such? Knowing how to respond in times of crisis is such an important thing. Jesus discerned what it was he had to do, how he had to respond. I think it's also interesting, the stress this must have. Can you imagine for Jairus? Yes, Jesus, let's keep going. If we could walk a bit faster, sort of thing, you know. She's really, really ill, my daughter, this sort of thing. And then, of course, Jesus stops. Imagine the sense of stress and sort of, no, not now. Not as my daughter is slipping away from me. This story isn't as important as this, what happened to Jairus, worried about his daughter. But I do remember when I was finishing my master's degree, I did it at a college called Spurgeon's. In the early 2000s, I was doing my master's degree at Spurgeon's, and I had a deadline for submitting my dissertation to the college. Now, some of you who know me well will know that I tend to work to a deadline. In other words, like the deadline was 10 o'clock, I think, that morning. It had to be in with the, submitted to the tutors for my dissertation. Well, I worked all night. I don't think I've ever done that before or since. I literally kept working because it was the conclusion, the pulling together of all the different strands of what I wanted to say in my master's dissertation. And so I worked all night. And by the morning, you know that light-headed sort of thing? You feel as though you're walking on sort of a cotton wool, I don't know. But I remember that feeling. And then that morning, my old computer printer decided to start messing me around. And I just remember being at the printer, and you know, the computer wouldn't recognize it, and the printer, it's there. What do you mean you can't recognize it? It's right next to you in all this business. You know, I went all through all of that. And in the end, I had to submit 3 copies of my dissertation. I managed to get the printer to print out 1 whole copy. And at the time, I was living up in Camberwell, and I then jumped in the car with all the bits of my dissertation, the 1 copy, ran into the college and spoke to one of the admin staff and just blurted out, "I've got to get this submitted for 10 o'clock. It's about an hour and a quarter's time. Can you?" And she was wonderful. She said, "Steve, don't worry. It's fine." She took me into her office and she just took the 1 copy, put it through her copy machine, and she said, "It's fine." Sure. And she even gave me those little binders that you need. She just was great, and she just helped me to settle down and not to worry. But I do remember, you know, in moments of crisis, the last thing you need is 1 more thing to drop on you, you know, your printer not working, or in this case, Jesus has decided there's something more important to deal with than my daughter who is close to death. Jesus also, he rebuked the mourners who, unlike him, could only see the situation in earthly human terms. They were unable to see beyond the situation as it was physically before them. But Jesus knew there was something more significant behind the scenes, behind the earthly, visible, physical reality. There was something more, and he could see and discern and sense that. So Jesus defied all human expectations, and he broke Jewish law. And he did all of that by touching a dead body. You may remember the story of the Good Samaritan, where, of course, the man is attacked on the road to Jericho, was it? Doesn't really matter too much. The reality is that he was attacked on that road, and because he looked as though he could be dead, these religious people didn't want to go anywhere near him, so they walked on the other side of the road. Because their religious holiness, their religious purity, mattered more than finding out whether that person was dead, and if they weren't, was there anything they could do for them? Because touching a dead body made you ritually unclean within the Jewish faith. So, Jesus was prepared to defy those taboos in order to bring what he knew God the Father wanted him to bring. And then once again, these are not words that Jesus said, but I think, you know, it is, we can see that this is what Jesus did in verse 43. Jesus needed to retain some control over his own story. This is one of the key themes that we get in Mark's gospel. Mark seeks to draw out we think Mark was the first of the 4 gospels to have been written. And we get this sense that Jesus is trying to keep the news of his miracles in particular quiet. He didn't want the word to get out too much. He wanted to keep them, you know, not too widely known. Why would he want to do that? Well, I'd suggest perhaps this was because he knew that he had a mission from God that the Father had given him, and he sensed that to achieve that mission, he had to delay the climax to his story. In other words, he knew that a confrontation was coming with the power of Satan, and that that would lead him to Jerusalem, and that whether he knew he would be crucified on a cross, we don't know, but certainly we know that he knew there would be a clash, a climax to his confrontation with the enemy and with all the powers of the enemy. But he knew that he had things that the Father had told him to do before he gets to that stage. And so he tried to get people not to talk too much about his ministry and about the miracles he'd done. In John chapter 7, verse 6, Jesus says, "The right time for me has not yet come." I think what Jesus is saying in that verse is the right time for me to fully reveal my identity and my purpose is not yet here, has not yet come. So perhaps that's why Jesus wanted to retain some control over his own story. Jairus' daughter needed her physical needs to be met as well. She needed food, and so in verse 43, Jesus says, "Give her some food." He doesn't just respond to her spiritual need, he also sees that she will need food after this incredible experience that she's been through. See, Jesus understands both human nature, the fact that people will want to talk about his story, but also understands basic human needs. When Jesus was tempted in the desert, we're told that at the end of the 40 days and nights, angels came and looked after him and fed him. When Jesus was on the cross, he said, "I'm thirsty." And somebody came and offered him something. Jesus had physical needs, and he knew what physical needs are like and how they were such a part of our human experience. You may know that we have pigeons everywhere in London, don't we, and in Croydon. They seem to be everywhere. But I was learning that actually there's a difference between your wood pigeon and what they call your feral pigeons. I don't know whether you knew this. So wood pigeons are those lovely sort of, they often have a bluey colour to them, and they have a little sort of like a light bit around their neck. And they're the ones that in the morning sometimes, particularly over the summer, spring and summer, you'll hear cooing. And they'll be outside on perhaps in a tree or something, and you can hear them cooing. And I don't know about you, when you're waking up in the morning, and I start to listen because they'll coo a few, and then they have a little stop. And then they restart again, you know. Well, those are your wood pigeons. Your feral London pigeon, they are very different. They'll be different colours and all this sort of thing. And sadly, quite a few of them I find have got one claw that's up like this and they're hobbling along like that. And that's your London pigeon, really. But they're quite different. And actually, one of the ways in which they are different is the sensitivity of the wood pigeon. So actually, if you have a group of wood pigeons together, they are very aware of the possibility of predators, other birds coming in to try and snatch one of them. And so, do you know the only bird that can come and fly into a group of wood pigeons without causing them all to scatter? It's only another wood pigeon. Any other bird, they won't accept another bird coming in because actually, they'll scatter and off they go. But only another wood pigeon can do it. Jesus was fully human and understood human nature, understood human need. And because he was fully human, he was able to fully enter into our experience. He's the one that's able to land amongst us, be amongst us, understand us, and really connect with us because he knows our experiences. I want to finish with these lovely words from Hebrews chapter 14. We do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses. But we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. We thank God that Jesus enters into our experience and therefore can minister to us because he fully understands our experience.